You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 280.
On today's show, we talk about rescue archaeology from melting glaciers, a Great Lakes Clovis site, and an anti-vampire burial in Poland.
Let's dig a little deeper. Make sure you're not face down. You'll just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
Happy birthday.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it has been my birthday recently.
When you're hearing this.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's been everyone's birthday. Technically.
Well, everybody does have a birthday. Yes.
Yes. That's happy birthday to the world.
How did this go from happy birthday to me to happy birthday to the world?
Well, we got to be inclusive. For everyone that's having a birthday right now, happy birthday.
There you go. Perfect.
Yes. Happy to all September birthdays.
Yeah. September is literally the best month in the whole world. Come at me. It is. It's still kind of summer. It's kind of getting fall. It's literally pumpkin spice comes out.
Leaves
start turning.
Your parents were happy at Christmas. It's all a good thing.
I mean, why do you gotta go there? No, I feel very fortunate to have been born in September because I do love this month so much. And also, I have the best song for my birthday.
What's
the song? The 21st of September. Do you remember? I'm not singing right now.
I don't.
If you don't get that.
No.
Okay.
Well, you know what's not good for September? Global warming.
Well, no, it's not really good for any time of the year.
Global warming can't exist, though, because it's getting colder right now.
That's not how that
Says
works.
Says people who don't know science.
So, yeah, always jumping on the arguments that the people on the wrong side make.
Yeah, well, you got to play both sides.
Yeah, I guess so. You have to understand where they're coming from, maybe.
Yeah, but global warming is good for archaeology.
It does have its moments, I guess. So call it a silver lining, I guess. And we've had topics like this before where we talk about sort of the silver lining of something like global warming. And this is just this article is another example of that.
I will say that journalists tend to get this wrong, though, because we have seen first off, this article title is Global Warming Archaeology Bonanza. It doesn't necessarily say it's good for archaeology, but I have seen articles in the past that say, you know, oh, global warming is great for archaeology. But depending on how you look at it, a lot of archaeologists and really kind of like stakeholders, and by stakeholders, people who are like ancestors or something like that, will say that the best preservation is to leave it buried and not touch it. So in a sense, global warming is really bad for archaeology because it's uncovering things that should remain buried because, you know, when they get uncovered, they get possibly destroyed.
Yeah. And as we'll talk about in this article, like, it becomes a salvage operation.
Yeah.
You don't have time to really study the context of where you're at and what's going on. And often this kind of uncovery,
the uncovery of it all.
Yeah. It's out of context, too, because the glaciers, you know, drag things around or whatever. So,
who's to say you're even going to find everything?
Well, yeah, too. True. You're going to miss half of it, too. So, okay, one other thing about global warming, and then we'll talk about the actual article. But, like, the flip side of global warming is that it's also covering up sites. as the glaciers melt and the seawaters rise, it's covering up sites on the other end. So, like, it might reveal things in the icy places, but it's covering them in the warm places. So, you know, double-edged sword, I guess.
There's archaeologists on both ends of the spectrum going, slow down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, can we just, like, wait a second? We need to record this site. Yeah. We need to be prepared to record sites over here. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, anyway.
There's a lot of things that normally don't preserve in the archaeological record.
Yeah.
Like fabric, hunting equipment, they call it, like wooden spears, arrow shafts, things like that. Like a lot of wood, basically.
Yeah.
Wood and fabric.
Wood, fabric, all those organic things that are not stone. They're not hardy. They don't make it through time.
Yeah, but they will be preserved under things like ice, things like that. I mean, sometimes for thousands of years.
Yeah, they can be.
Yeah.
Ice is the ultimate preserver, right? Like,
water, really.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so,
which is kind of ironic because once it's exposed to the elements, it starts to degrade rather quick.
Yeah. And that's why this is a a salvage operation, basically, yeah. because they have to go find these things because it's not like they have a map. So there's no treasure map pointing them to where things are going to be uncovered, right?
No.
So they have to go find them and then excavate quickly and really not even excavate, just recover them quickly before they deteriorate and are gone.
So one program that is trying to really kind of catch as much as they can in a place that has a lot of melting ice. Well, a place that had a lot of ice to begin with is Norway.
Yeah.
And the program is called the Glacier Archaeology Rescue Program.
Sounds so,
I don't know,
like romantic.
I know. I just like to call them GARP.
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 It's a good name. I like it.
I want to know what it is in Norwegian. Like, does it have some sort of really cool acronym in Norwegian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, they're on a quest to hunt for thawing artifacts in some of the most exposed areas. So they must have some, literally, heat maps, I would imagine, where they know where a lot of the thaw is happening more rapidly, probably.
Yeah, I suppose that is the only kind of map that could help them target areas, right? It's not going to show them things, but it'll at least show them where to look, maybe.
Well, and I wonder if, getting a little off track here, if they have sort of a cultural map along with a, you know, kind of an ice map
or
glacial map that shows them where some stuff may possibly intersect prehistorically
or historically.
But, or maybe they don't even know because it's under ice.
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, like migration paths, human migration paths might help point them.
Or also, as they're finding stuff, they're they're building maps as well.
Yeah, so, true. Yeah. So but, among the things that they have discovered recently is an Iron Age tunic that dates to 230 to 390 CE.
Yeah.
And this is long ago, 1800 years, but it's not like your, you know, Ice Age cultures. But again, what makes this super significant and interesting is that it's fabric. To actually have fabric that is almost 2,000 years old, that's what's so insane about this and so unique. And this particular tunic was made from very fine lamb or sheep's wool, and it is woven in a diamond twill pattern.
Yeah. It's really cool when you look at the pictures, too, because they actually have the picture in the article here of it just, like, laying on the ground as it was discovered.
Yeah.
All, like, dirty and just,
like, crumpled up.
You could easily walk over it.
Doesn't it look like somebody, like, was a little bit warm and they, like, took off their over tunic and, like, crumpled it up next to them while they were sitting on a rock having lunch and then, like, walked off without
it? Just totally walked away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I can totally imagine somebody doing. Everybody's done that, right?
Yeah. Kind of looks that way, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody's super pissed off and just, like, turned around and just, like, where is my tunic?
Well, they probably were pissed off because it seems like this was a very nice and very warm tunic. Yeah, so.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've also found what they call scaring sticks.
Yeah.
That would have been used by reindeer hunters to drive animals where they would be killed. And I imagine these sticks were either they would, like, whack them together or whack them on the ground or something like that.
Yeah.
And literally scaring sticks to, you know, scare reindeer.
To drive them into a place where it was easier to, you know, kill one or two or however many they could handle at once. So,
And of course, archaeologists being archaeologists, they're suggesting that one of those hunters could have worn this tunic. I mean, that's a little bit of a stretch.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Did they find these next to each other? Were the sticks in the tunic?
I know. I always want to know more about the context before we, like, make that kind of association.
Yeah.
If it was in the pocket of the tunic, okay.
Right.
Like, sure, that makes sense.
Right.
But if it was just nearby, I don't know if I would make that association.
Yeah, what is a person-shaped tunic with, like, sticks in the ends of the arms? I don't think so.
Right. But it is still, the story is really intriguing because we know those kind of people doing that kind of thing occupied this area. So making that association is somewhat logical, even if it lacks hard evidence.
Yeah. The cool thing about this is you can see some of the modifications to the tunic.
Yeah.
And I think this is where you come in because they make some claims in the write-up here that are a little bit misleading.
Well, they do. And
because I wouldn't have seen it.
Yeah. Now, the first thing they said is that it looks like it might have been sleeveless originally when it was first made, and then the sleeves were added later. And that does look legit. Like, when you look at it, you can see a difference in the fabric between the sleeves and the body, and possibly even up in the collar, but that might just be because it's the inside, too. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. And then the other thing that they said, and I think this is just somebody who's not really understanding how twills work, so I can go into that just super briefly, but a woven twill fabric is by nature made of two colors. That's how you get those patterns, the diamond patterns. The, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you can do it in one pattern. That would be like your jeans or your twill pants mm-hmm. if they're in one color, but then they're not in a, it's not a pattern. It's just a fabric.
All of my twill pants are like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no twill pants. Yeah,
but like look closely at your jeans and you will see that there is like a pattern there mm-hmm. in the jeans, but it's a pretty basic one. That's your single color. But when you get into these diamond patternings and stuff like that, that's when you use two colors for the warp and the weft, and you get the different shapes and patterns. And I know a little bit of something about this because I had a loom at one point and I was doing twill patterning on that loom. So that's what they have done here. So in the description of the different parts of the tunic, the article does say that there's patchy coloration, and they say specifically it's not due to uneven bleaching by sunlight. And that's true. It's not. This thing was frozen first and then covered by a layer of snow. Like, it's probably never seen the light. So that probably didn't happen. And the coloration is in the wrinkles. It's in the shape of the wrinkles that it was found mm-hmm. in. So it's not wear from the person. But it also isn't because of the two colors of wool that they used either. They didn't make that mottled looking effect on purpose, I guess, right. is what I'm trying to say. That is from whatever happened to it after it was dropped and then preserved. The two colors of wool were used to make the diamond shape that you can see in one of the pictures. And then there's another picture below it that shows sort of more of an intermixing.
Yeah.
And that color was also made by the two colors of wool.
Those are the insets on the
Yeah, exactly. So just a little bit of a clarification on what they mean by the two colors.
Yeah, cool.
It's really neat. Those kind of twills are complicated to make, so it's definitely a more advanced like weaving mm-hmm. technique, and it's really cool to see it on such an old piece of fabric like this. Too bad they lost it. I bet they were very sad about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess with that, we hope that they, you know, continue on with this work and really, you know, keep getting funding, because that's usually what stops work like this. But hopefully they keep getting funding, because I don't think the climate's going to warm anytime soon. And it's probably going to continue getting warmer and melting before it gets colder. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But all right. Well, with that, we are going to move over to closer to where Rachel and I are. And by, well, not really, but closer to the United States anyway.
We have been there recently-ish.
We actually went real close to here as we passed through Lower Michigan. But we're going to go by Lower Michigan and learn a little bit about the oldest, at least the currently oldest, archaeology site in Michigan that was found just a few years ago with some recent discoveries. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Back on the other side. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 280. And this article is from Newsweek and a few other places, called Prehistoric Native American Tools Reveal What They Ate at Great Lakes Camp. I think they're kind of burying the lead there.
Or just sort of giving the whole thing away and like the title.
Well, yeah, but it's also like the oldest site found in Michigan and a Clovis site, something that had never been found in Michigan.
Oh, so that was all new for Michigan.
That was all new for Michigan. Yeah, it's like, you know, this is clearly not written by an archaeologist. And to me, that is actually a lot more important than what they ate. Who cares?
I mean, kind of, but we'll get to it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this was found in the Great Lakes region of the United States of America. So if you're not familiar with the USA, there's a whole bunch of big lakes made by glaciers. And they're right in the middle, up top, near Canada.
Yeah. We share them with Canada, really.
Yeah. Well, we do. Yeah. Some of them. Some of them we keep to ourselves, and some of them we share with Canada. So.
Well, I think most of them we share with Canada, actually, except for maybe Michigan.
Yeah.
Lake Michigan.
But no, we kind of share that.
Does Michigan...
Like an edge of it?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think Michigan might fully enclose Lake Michigan, but
might be right.
Anyway,
the Belson site, they call it, dates to about 13,000 years ago and is located in southwest Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it contains artifacts from the Clovis culture.
Yes.
And they were first reported on in a paper that was published in 2021. So more information coming out of this study, apparently.
Yeah, they keep...
this site, not study.
Yeah, they keep researching here and digging here. And this same team, recently publishing in PLOS ONE, has revealed new discoveries. The Clovis people likely returned annually to the site over several years. That's the new research.
Yeah, which totally makes sense because these people were, you know, migratory, right? They followed game, they followed food, they followed the seasons, and they had passes they went on. So it would totally make sense that you would go back to somewhere that was protected and a place that, you know, you liked being at in the previous season. Why not, right?
Yeah, and in anthropological circles, you kind of learn about this in sort of anthropology 101. It's called a seasonal round because they probably had other places they went to in the year as well.
Yeah.
So, and the reason this, the reason for this is because they were likely following things like game and other things that they ate, right? So not only game, but, you know, flora, plants.
They were probably running from snow at some point. Like they'd had enough of it. Time to move on. Don't want to be here anymore.
They're basically the first snowbirds. So that's why they ended up in Mexico. At
they
the
were snowbirds.
Site.
It's perfect. I mean, that's the way we live right now, currently, chasing 70, right?
Well, like I said, that's why they ended up in New Mexico at the Clovis type site.
Well, these exact people did?
These exact people. They went down to New Mexico, founded the Clovis type site. And then,
That's a big claim.
So that's where they get their name, if you haven't heard us talk about this before, is Clovis, New Mexico is an actual place.
Yes.
That's the first place that this particular projectile point, spear point, if you will, was found. It's a very particular type of thing. It's got straight sides fitted onto the end of a spear. It's got what's called a flute down the end of it, which is just a really long, flat flake taken out of it on both sides.
Yeah, and it would have made it easy to haft it onto whatever they were wielding it with. So.
Yeah, well, typically a spear.
Yeah,
they didn't have
a spear.
Arrows yet.
Yeah, so. It would have been too big and heavy for an arrow anyway.
But, yeah, it would have been. So
I just mean material-wise. It could have been whatever kind of material they were hafting it to. Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, that's where this was. This was named for the place it was found. The actual site it was found at was called Blackwater Draw, but it was found inside of a mastodon or a mammoth, one of the
something
two.
Something like that, yeah.
One of the mammoth things, one of the big elephant-looking things. So anyway, it was, at Clovis, New Mexico. But these points have been, you know, linked to what they just call Clovis culture because they haven't linked it to, like, a particular, you know, Native American culture. They just call it all Clovis culture because of this point type. And it's all over North and South America. So,
yeah, these were some of the earliest people that were in North and South America. And this was just the typical type of point that those people use. And and it does make a connection between all of them, although there very certainly would have been regional differences among all the people. So,
yeah. Now, the problem with Clovis culture is that it's sort of incorrectly, I believe, makes it sound like it's one culture of people that is populating across two continents during a couple thousand years history in this hemisphere.
Yeah.
And taking this knowledge of this projectile point and just, you know, proliferating it across both continents, right?
Right.
Which is more than likely completely false.
Yeah. These people were all very different. They had lots of, I mean, they were living in very different places in some cases.
Yeah.
So you can't assume that they were that similar. But this lithic technology did spread among all the people or was developed independently. I think there's a lot of argument about that as well. So we're not going to get into that. But
I mean, to get into it a little bit, I think personally that there was a combination of the two, because I think there's only so many ways to crack a stone to haft it on the end of a spear personally. But also, I think that it did spread a little bit. You know, people see something and they like it. You know, people find something, they pick it up and go, that's cool. How do I make that? And then they try it and they make it and then it works, right?
Yeah.
So I think that those ideas can spread and they do spread because it works, right?
You copy.
Learn and you do what works, right?
Yep.
But I also think that it can be independently invented because nowadays we've worked in so many different parts of the country and you see the same types of points. They might have small different regional variations, but you see the same types of points with their same shapes and their same little ears and notches and corners and all that stuff.
That's true.
But there are 100 different names for the same shape.
There are.
Because now people give different names to things, right? But for some reason, Clovis got one name and, you know, Folsom got one name and mm-hmm. some of these things got one name. And now it's Clovis culture.
I guess there's less variation maybe back in the earlier times.
It's so distinctive.
And it is very distinctive.
It's very distinctive. So now Michigan has Clovis site now.
Yeah.
And it's not the Belson Point, right? It's the Clovis Point.
It is.
So anyway, something significant here is this site, one of the significant things about it is it was under ice. The Wisconsin glaciation began around 100,000 to 75,000 years ago mm-hmm. and was part of the most recent ice age that ended about 11,000 years ago. So these guys were like looking at a George R. R. Martin-esque wall of ice just to the north of them.
Right.
Yeah, it was creating the Great Lakes at the time. They had just pulled back and they're going, hey, that big area of that lake is getting a lot bigger.
Yeah.
That one right next to us.
Right.
It just keeps filling up.
just keeps getting deeper. What's happening?
That valley we walked through to get here, what happened to it? I can't even see across it now.
Right.
So there's like when I was a kid.
Oh my God. You know,
anyway, but as a result, Michigan was completely covered in ice, as well as the rest of the northern part of the continent. So, but the ice had receded in some parts of southern Michigan by 13,000 years ago, of course, because they wouldn't be there otherwise.
Right.
And this site is thought of as one of the earliest archaeological sites as a result. So as ice was melting, people were just like moving on in because vegetation was growing back up. Mm-hmm. It was very fertile soil and animals were coming in and eating it and people were falling in and eating them.
Yeah, exactly. And evidence suggests that the Clovis people visited this site annually for at least 3 to 5 years. And it was probably in the summer. And I suppose they can tell that by probably the levels of hearth activity. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess anyway, because otherwise, how could you say specifically 3 to 5 years? What would you think on that?
Probably. And I would imagine the hearths probably move around a little bit or there's layers of them or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Well, this was what I thought was one of the coolest things about this site, because it's not often that we get to do this kind of analysis. And also, many Clovis points that are known in this country were collected in the olden times before this kind of analysis could be done. And that is protein analysis on the tools. And you can do this protein analysis to see what kind of things they were cutting with the tools.
Yeah.
And then that would give you an idea as to what they were eating, right?
Yeah.
And you have to collect the tools in a certain way to preserve that data. And I think that we probably have lost that from older tools. Oh, yeah.
And you know why?
Why?
Because archaeologists back in the day, and some still today, would just pick it up and lick it.
Okay, they lick pottery, not tools, or bone. Maybe it's bone. Is it bone that you lick? I don't know. I don't lick anything.
Pottery to figure out what it is.
Right.
Yeah. So.
I don't think people are licking stone tools, typically.
I think they just lick stuff because they're like, archaeology.
But they certainly were getting contaminated, right? Like, if you have deli meat for lunch, you have turkey meat in your sandwich, and then you go touch a tool, you're transferring some of that to it, and then it just corrupts the entire sample, right?
Those archaeologists that eat like a can of sardines for lunch, like everything has sardines on it after lunch.
That's so gross. Nobody eats that. That's just mean.
Oh, we know somebody.
Well, okay. Yeah, so that's gross. Yeah. But anyway, that would contaminate the sample. And so many older sites, you just can't do this kind of analysis. But we know now that we can do this, so...
Yeah.
You know, sites that are found today, you can protect these tools and then do this kind of analysis. So I'm not sure how much other evidence they have of the diet through the protein analysis of the tools, but I'm sure that archaeologists are looking out for that these days so that we can do that kind of work.
Yeah, so some of the animals they were able to come up with based on this analysis was muskox, caribou, or deer. They kind of present the same way.
Yeah,
Hare, or rabbits, an extinct peccary, which is a pig-like animal.
You know what's not on that list? Mammoth or mastodon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because...
They might not have just been up in that area.
They might not have been in that area. That could be happenstance. Yeah. We do know that Clovis points were used to kill them because there's many kill sites that have, you know, Clovis points in them.
A lot of Clovis points have been found in them.
Yes, exactly. So we know for sure they were doing it. But what is interesting about this is that it just, again, shows that Clovis people didn't necessarily only hunt big game.
Right.
They would adapt to what was available to them. And in this particular area, it must have been those smaller animals. Although, I mean, smaller... When we're talking about a muskox or a caribou, like those are still pretty big animals.
Pretty good size.
Yeah. I probably still had to go through some effort to get those, to take one of those down, but still. Yeah.
Yeah. And they probably also ate plants and things like that as well, because how could you not? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to eat things that are easy to eat and aren't going to kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how we find out how plants don't kill you.
Especially if this was a summertime camp. That's when all the green veggie mm-hmm. things are alive. So they must have been eating veggies too. Yeah. But the evidence of those did not survive in this particular case.
I can imagine just sitting out there going, ugh, salad. Ooh, caribou.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
They probably were eating like nuts and things too.
Yeah.
I wonder if they can do analysis for that kind of food.
Right.
Although I guess you don't really cut those with a knife, do you? Why would you cut a nut with a knife?
Well, you'd have to crush them with other rocks.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Maybe.
So, it probably wouldn't show up on there.
Right.
Anyway, the site is positioned over a river channel. I have some comments about that. With good views where people likely watched herbivores crossing the spring, where they would kill and eat them. Mm-hmm. So they would just have good visibility.
Yeah.
Now, that's what the article said, positioned over a river channel. We don't really have a picture of that necessarily.
No, not exactly.
But I'm wondering, is the site currently positioned over a river channel? And was it positioned over a river channel? Because this area of Michigan has a lot of soil. Mm-hmm. I don't know how deep the bedrock is, but typically in these glacial areas, there's a lot of glacial till, there's a lot of soil, there's a lot of area like that. So rivers would be moving around a lot. They just move around a lot. Rivers do.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering where the river was 13,000 years ago.
I mean, they must have evidence that it was here, because that is something that archaeologists are well aware of. So whoever's doing this work knows where they were in proximity to the river.
It just says is positioned and not was positioned. Like, if it is positioned now, what are the chances it was positioned there 13,000 years ago?
I mean, I hear you. That might just be bad wording by the journalists, though.
Unless it's moved and moved and moved and now it's moved back. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it currently is positioned and was positioned, which is obviously possible, because a lot of times rivers will contain themselves within an area. Maybe because of the bedrock, the river is contained within an area that has always been suited to this area, you know, which is totally possible. So anyway, smaller game would have been hunted more opportunistically, of course, and larger game would have been followed. So
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense, right? Obviously. Yeah.
Okay, so while these guys were over there hunting game, people over in Poland were trying to keep vampire children from coming back from the dead. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to episode 280 of the Archaeology Show, and now it's time for more vampires.
I know, I love this. And we did a whole episode on like vampires and vampire burials and vampire lore that led to vampire burials back in the day last year for Halloween. So we'll try to find that episode and link to it, because it was fun.
Yes.
It was fun. I did not know how much vampire stuff that you can find in the archaeology record, just because of, you know, suspicious ideas people had in the past. Not suspicious, that's not the right word, but just different folklore notions people had in the past.
They took it pretty seriously, apparently.
Sure did in this case.
This article is called Medieval Vampire Child Burial Used Extreme Measures to Keep Dead in Grave. Mm-hmm. And it's also from Newsweek. So a site on Góra Chełmska, which is a ridge near Kozelin in northwestern Poland, a team have made an interesting discovery.
Yes, the skeletons of two children have been found without coffins.
No coffins. You think a coffin would at least contain them a little more.
Yeah, that is interesting. Is it, maybe it's a like...
Coffins are only reserved for
Christians.
Religious people.
Yeah. And you were a vampire, so therefore you don't get a coffin? Maybe. I don't know.
I feel like if you could put a vampire in a coffin, you could just like really strap that thing down.
I mean, coffins are their beds, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true.
Depending on which story you're reading, but...
I know. But like, you could also like nail the crap out of a coffin, right?
You can. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
So
both of the skeletons of these children were laid on their backs with their skulls facing west.
Not west.
I mean, I don't know why that matters for a vampire. I don't know.
Well, I mean, facing east in some cultures is often like towards Jerusalem, but not in Poland.
Yeah.
Facing east is China in Poland.
Well, it could be the rising sun setting something, but
right.
Yeah. So these two were dated to the 13th century based on associated pottery sherds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other known cemeteries in this area, which I also thought was interesting, because usually not usually, but often you find these types of graves outside of the bounds of a cemetery where, you know, regular Christians would be buried. So, but these are just sort of off on their own, it sounds like.
Yeah, but that just means maybe we haven't found another cemetery. So
it's true. It's true. But this is only medieval. It's 13th century. It's not even that long ago. Like, not comparatively speaking in the archaeology record. But yeah.
One of the graves displays anti-vampire characteristics, which that also surprises me that only one of them does. They're both kind of buried there.
Yeah. Were they buried together or were they found in their own separate burials near each other? That was this is like the whole journalism versus paper thing, like academic paper. This is just a journalistic report of a cool thing, not the actual like academic paper.
Yeah, one of the graves displays what they call anti-vampire characteristics, and is known as a revenant grave, technically.
Yeah.
Revenant is the term for that.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's in the folklore of several cultures, as we mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. We'll definitely link back to that old episode, because we kind of went in detail about the different folklore, the origins, and that kind of stuff.
The term revenant refers to a person who comes back from the dead as a spirit or reanimated corpse to terrorize the living. I'm like, really? Specifically to terrorize the living, or just like to live a fancy life with a velvet jacket?
Well, that's what vampires have become. But I think the way it started, if I remember correctly from the last time we talked about this, is like often a disease would like tear through a town and they just needed a reason or an explanation. So like the first person to get it became the one who caused it all, right? Yeah. They had to blame somebody, so they just blame the first person. They become the revenant who came out of their graves and then passed this disease along or terrorized the rest of the village. So not necessarily fair, but it was how they mentally handled that situation.
Well, graves like this have dated back thousands of years and are found all across Europe, because probably as long as people have been living in groups, bigger groups, and disease and things like this have been taking hold, that's probably as long as this is dated to.
Yeah.
You know, you always need someone to blame.
Yeah. And like, I kind of get it, right? It's easier to blame the dead than the living, right? Like, they are already dead, and at least they're not doing terrible things to somebody who's still alive. You know, sure, blame the dead if that makes you feel better about the situation.
It's probably a fundamental lack of understanding, too, about disease and death. You know, somebody may have thought to have been died, especially like in bed or something like that. Or maybe they actually put them in the ground, but they just had either were unconscious, had a low heart rate, something like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, started banging on their coffin, or, you know, banging on the, or literally coming out of the dirt or something like that, but actually weren't dead.
Right. Right.
You know, they were just very sick or something like that. And, you know, that's how these things come around. So, like I said, fundamental misunderstanding of medicine.
Yeah, definitely.
But anyway, people have taken various precautions to prevent the dead from rising, which is horrific to think that you're possibly barely alive and possibly even conscious of something. Probably most of these people were actually dead when these things happened.
Of course. Yeah. They were
not actually just sick and kind of unconscious.
Oh, I doubt they were. Yeah. They were dead. I mean, people weren't that monstrous. Not even in a place and time when they didn't understand disease, right? Not usually, anyway.
But some of these things included placing large stones on the legs or piercing the body with a lance to fix it to the ground. I love these, because if somebody gets reanimated and they're essentially immortal, I mean, how long is that actually going to stop them?
Oh, right.
I mean, probably not. I mean, maybe a little bit, but not forever. Yeah, another one that I thought was really kind of funny was burying them face down. So when they reanimate and just start digging,
they just go the wrong direction.
They just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Right. Yeah. It's like, well, again, eventually, you know, let's just come out the other side.
Well, no, not that exactly. But I don't know that it will fool them for very long. But hey, maybe it will. You know, you got to do what you got to do to try to protect your living family, right?
Yeah. But there does seem to be one surefire way to maybe stop them from coming back.
You would think, right? Maybe, but, you know, they are dead, so they could do magical things, but...
Yes.
In this case, one of the recently discovered children had its head removed from its torso completely.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, one of the burials we talked about last year also was a head removal situation with the leg, like, down between... Or with the head down between the legs or whatever. In this case, the skull was just placed face down, and then they put stones on top of the torso, I guess, by separating the head and then putting stones on the torso. That would somehow stop the child from coming back as a vampire.
Yep. The burial also appears to have been marked by two pillars because they saw post holes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, when they were digging. So, and for anybody, if we haven't talked about this before, when you are doing an excavation, you can actually see evidence of where wooden posts were in the ground. And yeah. Even if the wood is gone,
right.
The wood essentially, I don't want to say turns into dirt, but it kind of turns into dirt.
Well, it does. It starts decomposing. And the dirt where it was is darker because it's stained by the decomposition of the wood that was there originally.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
You can literally excavate post holes, and they call them post molds.
Yeah, and they'll be perfectly circular.
Yeah.
It's very clear when you're excavating one of those.
They'll be the shape of the
post. Of whatever the post was. Yeah. So usually circular because, trees.
Yeah. Well, depends on how well somebody cut it.
I mean, like...
Perfectly circular? I mean, how good was the woodsmith?
Okay,
the lumberjack.
Well, they were usually circular, but anyway... Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, so I wonder why they would be marking it. Was it like a don't come near here, there might be a vampire marking, do you think?
Could have been.
Another thing that's missing from this article is like the context, more context around these burials, bigger context. Like, are they near a village? We know it's not associated with another cemetery, but are we near a village? And this is like they put up some kind of marking using these post holes to stop people from coming over there or what, like... If it's out in the middle of nowhere, what's the point?
Yeah. But,
yeah.
Hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, these were all common techniques for burials of what people thought were demons in some cultures.
Yeah.
So anyway, they removed all this, which I think was probably, not super smart. Probably should have just reburied it and put some more rocks on top of it. But,
yeah. Now the kid's going to be a vampire. Good job, guys.
Yeah.
Better get my stake out.
I know. But anyway, they removed it, and it's awaiting further analysis.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Hopefully find out more. Maybe they'll get an actual, academic study out, which will give more details as to the actual context. Because I'm always interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Archaeology is never just the one thing. It's the bigger picture around the thing that really tells you so much more about it. And with journalism, like, they do very much get focused on the thing and not the overall picture, which... I like the picture.
Yes. Pictures are good.
Pictures are good. I'm simple. Draw me a picture.
Draw me a word picture. It's called Active.
I cannot.
Deep fans of the Archaeology Podcast Network.
I cannot with the word pictures.
Anyway. All right. Well, with that... We actually have some interesting episodes coming up here in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a couple of interview-based episodes, and we've got one of them is a little bit of a promo for the Archaeos Film Festival coming up, which you may have seen in our socials.
Mm-hmm.
We're promoting the trailer for it because we are doing some interviews with some of the filmmakers.
Yeah, super exciting.
Yeah, that's coming up in October, actually, and there is some
The film festival is.
The film festival is.
Yes.
Actually, there's a YouTube short, and I think it's also on our Instagram, so if you go check out ArcPodNet on YouTube and on our Instagram, you can see the trailer for that, but keep an eye out for that because that's coming up in mid-October, and it's a virtual film festival, and it's free.
Yeah.
And we've actually seen a number of the short films, and you can just log in, and you have a week because it's, it's all proprietary films, so you don't have forever, but you have a week to go actually watch some of these. And there's some long-form ones as well, which we haven't actually watched yet. We're going to do that when it comes out. But the short ones are anywhere from 6-7 minutes to, 20-25 minutes. A lot of the ones we've seen are really well done.
So. Oh, yeah. So great.
Yeah.
Yep.
But definitely check that out. It's nice to see a virtual film festival. You can watch it from anywhere in the world.
Definitely.
So, anyway, all archaeology and kind of history focused. So,
yeah.
Anyway, with that, look out for more information coming on that. And with that, we will see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.